Hello, everybody. I'm Dwayne Mancini, and welcome to another episode of the Project MedTech Podcast. If you need anything from us or would like to suggest a future guest, you can email us at info@projectmedtech.com. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review, and you can always visit our new website, www.projectmedtech.com, or follow us on LinkedIn. If you are enjoying this content, don't forget to check out our other podcasts by searching MedTech Money on your favorite podcast platform or by heading to our website. MedTech Money is an interview-style podcast focused on demystifying raising and investing capital for medtech startups. In this episode, our guests, Niall Casey, Neil Thompson, Kevin Buckley, and I discuss when you need to be thinking about intellectual property, where do you start in order to protect your idea, the price to file and hold patents, the importance of IP and acquisition, the importance of law, business, and science on your team, the ability to patent software and the importance of strategy, China, and intellectual property, and so much more. So without further ado, my discussion with Niall Casey, Neil Thompson, and Kevin Buckley.
Medical innovation starts with medical discussion. Talking about the future and what comes next with Project MedTech.
Okay, Niall, Neil, and Kevin, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dwayne.
Yeah. So, Kevin and Neil, you guys are now, this will be the second episode we've done together. Niall, first time. Let's just go around the horn. We'll start with Niall, then move down to Neil and Kevin and just do some brief intros for the listeners.
Sure. So, Niall Casey, I'm a registered patent attorney as well as a traditional development engineer in the medical device space. I've worked at large companies, as large as Johnson & Johnson, and then ultimately progressed to smaller companies in specifically the spine space. So it's a subset of orthopedics. It's a division called spine, where it handles pathology, correction of pathologies in the spine. That includes both the soft tissue replacement of the disc, as well as augmentation of bony tissue. The size of the companies that I've worked for has been increasingly smaller. So at the start of my career, a huge multinational corporation, eventually going to smaller and smaller companies until I founded with another friend of mine, Carlsmed, which is a patient-specific spinal implant company. And that brings us to today.
Perfect. And Neil and Kevin?
I am Neil Thompson. I am a patent agent with Torrey Pines Law Group. And before that, I worked for a number of years as a product development engineer in the medical device industry, more specifically spinal implants.
And I, Kevin Buckley, I'm the founder and I guess leader of Torrey Pines Law Group. It's been around for almost 9 years. Was in big law, partner in big law before this. And before that, I was a biochemist. So, it's been an interesting ride.
Awesome. And just for all the listeners, like I said, Kevin and Neil, second time on the podcast. The first episode is episode 35, where we covered a lot of when to think about it and how IP fits in the overall company strategy. And today we're going to kind of talk about this being actually deployed in a real company, right? And kind of talk a little bit about a case example. So, you know, I think it probably makes most sense, Niall, to start with you, right? And kind of talk about, okay, you founded the company, you're a patent attorney, right? You said that's in a previous life, you were doing more of that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So obviously it probably clicked for you, but maybe just talk about that evolution of, okay, you have the idea, you know, when do you engage Kevin and Neil and what's that first conversation like?
Sure. Right. So especially at a startup, so I'll focus this around, you know, there's an idea floating around in your head or in someone's head, and there's an opportunity somewhere to commercialize it and deliver it to the market. But it's not under the umbrella of a large corporation that would be able to help support this mission. So it's kind of you on your own. So it starts with that idea kicking around your head. You either know the space, you know the industry, or you recognize that there's an unmet need somewhere. So you have, just by virtue of thinking about it, noodling on it, you've come up with a solution of some kind. What's really important is to protect that idea. And so one way to use, I would say, a limited amount of resources is to begin to protect that idea, begin to flush it out in your mind, and then ultimately apply some level of protection around it so that others can't come in and say, what a great idea, I'm going to apply it to my company or, you know, to help line my pockets. So the way to do that right off the bat is filing a provisional patent application. So that gives you 1 year of time to figure out maybe the nuts and bolts or raise some money to help ultimately protect that idea in earnest by a full utility patent. So you have 1 year as a provisional patent application holder to then file, based on that idea, a utility patent. So it gives you that 1 year to really iron out a couple of kinks in the design, perhaps, or to raise money to help fund that protection in the full protection of the utility patent. So you have this idea kicking around, you have limited resources, you now filed a provisional patent application, perhaps it's converting to a utility application, but you don't have anything, it's just an idea. Now comes the kind of overlay of a product development endeavor. So you got this idea, you got it well protected, or at least the beginnings of it well protected. Now you want to make this. Perhaps it's a prototype that you can use to raise money, to help showcase your idea, to garner support or momentum behind this idea, behind this product. Got it protected. Now it's time to put the rubber to the road on the development side of things. So with limited resources, you have a network of perhaps outside manufacturers, whether they're rapid prototypers, 3D printers, additive manufacturing, or traditional, you know, contract manufacturer for hire, where they're able to make a prototype for you. So those two things begin to get more and more connected as you march through time. And so the idea itself, you should be able to protect that. And then the physical embodiment of that idea, you should be able to use to drive your business forward, whether it's raising money or garnering interest or even, you know, pitching it to other companies as an opportunity for them to license or acquire that technology. So those two things kind of stack onto each other at some point in probably the first year or 18 months or so.
Okay. So let's pause there. A provisional patent. So we'll Kevin and Neil, maybe you can talk a little bit about this. What is, and this is just a raw question because I don't have any patents, right? So what is a patentable idea, right? Like, how different do you have to be from something that's already out there? And I'm guessing there's no straightforward answer here, but can you talk a little bit about this? Because I think it's confusing for me. It's like, okay, if I took my iPhone and made, you know, what is patentable here, right? What's the next step? I mean, I think that's just confusing for people who don't know this space. So can we demystify this a little bit here?
Hey, Dwayne, Neil's going to tackle this, but I just got to tell you something funny. Our guy, Steve Stupp, our colleague, he patented the first iPhone.
Okay, there we go. So, I wish this was planned. That would have been really, really cool, but this is even better.
if you want an honest answer, get him on the next podcast.
All right, yeah. Perfect.
But you know, right. You tackle the provisional question.
Yeah, so when it comes to what's patentable, you need to show that the invention is novel and non-obvious. The novel part is perhaps a bit easier. It's just proving that whatever you're inventing hasn't been invented before. It's that non-obvious part that can be a bit tricky, because typically what a patent examiner will do is they'll take a bunch of patents and patent applications together, put them together, and then say that this combination is essentially the same as what you're trying to patent. And then you have to, you as the patent practitioner, either a patent agent or patent attorney, has to come up with an argument as to why perhaps the combination was improper. It doesn't actually make your invention. And that's what keeps me up at night, I guess. Not necessarily the novelty part. It's the non-obvious part.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, on top of that, there's patent eligibility too, which has been crazy since the Alice case. It's a U.S. Supreme Court case from 2014. Prior to that, in this space, in the kind of the biological side of medical devices, Myriad has been a problem, and AMP. So you have to look at also what natural products might be part of a device or an invention or an idea or a concept. And you try to draft claims that avoid patenting a natural product of any sort. So in medical devices for spinal implants, we've worked with neochondrocytes, which are, you know, part of the human body. And you can't get a patent just on a neochondrocyte, but certainly systems and methods and the device itself, which can incorporate neochondrocytes or things like that. So those things would be patentable, but just a natural product, no.
Okay, got it. All right, so Niall, at what point do you engage Torrey Pines? Or I'm assuming you guys have worked together, right? Which is how this relationship was formed. So you have not.
No. And that's what's so fun about this.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Niall is not a client, so we can say whatever we want.
Right? Yeah. Perfect. Okay. Even better. So, okay, how much of this provisional patent portion of it plays into your overall business strategy, right? I'm guessing quite a bit.
Yeah, especially in that first year, right? The provisional patent kind of puts a mark on the calendar and really saves your place in line, because one of the as Neil alluded to, one of the key components of a patent is that it must be new. And so there's a temporal aspect of that. You have to have beat somebody to this idea. Otherwise, you know, it's likely not patentable, being it's not new anymore. So a provisional patent application factors in pretty heavily towards establishing that point in time that this idea exists now, and it didn't exist before that. So that provisional patent application gives you a 1 year. You can obviously put your pin in the calendar, and then you have 12 months after that to organize resources, whether they're capital resources or design resources, in order to maybe perfect that idea or ultimately pursue legitimate protection. Because the provisional patent application, while it does set a day and time, it doesn't actually afford any protection. It's kind of just a 1 year pre-grace period for you to figure things out, raise capital to pursue ultimate protection of a utility patent application and ultimately a utility patent.
Okay, so before we move on from this, then we can go to the next step. How much? If you're final provisional patent, you're going to raise capital. You're probably really, really early, right? Pre-seed, seed round.
That's right. Yeah.
So, yeah. Sorry. Real quick, to finish that question, because I want to hear from all three of you on this. How sophisticated are the investors at that stage that they're asking questions about a provisional patent? I'm curious, because most of those rounds are friends and family, high net worth individuals. And while some might know, I'm guessing, you know, at least in my experience with the startups I support, those investors honestly have a lot of times no idea what is coming down the pipeline for a med tech company. So I'm curious on, are you facing that question when you're raising money? And Kevin and Neil, I guess the question for you guys would be, you know, are you finding yourselves having to educate clients, investors on this? And so let's start there.
Sure. So yeah, you're right. When you're raising, when you just got an idea, it's very unlikely that Silicon Valley venture capitalist firms or venture capitalist individuals are rushing to give you millions of dollars to carry that idea forth to the market. What is more likely is you have an idea, you socialize it amongst your peer group, your friends, perhaps it sounds funny, but the generation above you, so your parents and their network, perhaps, or a mentor that you've had in college, and the people who have had a chance to accumulate some personal wealth and they want to place a bet on you as an individual and your ideas, because they know you, they believe in you, and they think there's something to come out of it. It's not just a charity work. So it's a less than sophisticated group or pool of investors as compared to Silicon Valley. But I can tell you that there's legitimate pressure raising money from friends and family. These are people that you're going to see at holidays. These are people who are receiving Christmas cards from you, people that you know around town. So the sophistication maybe isn't there, but the impact and the intensity, it remains there.
Yeah, and Kevin and Neil, I'm curious, when you're working with clients, do you find yourselves getting pulled into these conversations to explain what this is? Or are most of these investors just saying, oh yeah, they have a provisional patent, great, and no idea what that maybe means?
Yeah, so it's unique for each client. So in a company like Niles, we might get involved in those conversations. On the other end of the spectrum, if a company is in stealth mode, they've already got maybe $100 million or about that, then they're filing provisional patent applications like crazy, in addition to looking at FDA regulatory pathways, 510K, 510K de novo. They're looking at KOLs. They're talking to policy advisors, reimbursement advisors to get your CPT code. So it really can be a very sophisticated conversation with people who have done this for 30 years and have killed it and made $1 billion or more, all the way down to the mom and pop shop, where you really have to explain things. And the provisional itself, or multiple provisionals, it's really a tool, like Niall said, it's a placeholder. Mm-hmm. And if you're in a place where, in that 1 year gap period between provisional and non-provisional, if you're doing proof of concept, developing minimum viable product, you're going to throw all of that real world device, real world data, any improvements in that 1 year gap period into the non-pro, investors often have a say in what that non-pro looks like. And then here's a real trick. Not everything is patentable. Not everything is something you want to patent. A lot of our clients don't want to patent their secret sauce, because their competitors will know it instantly. Once the patent application publishes, secret sauce is out there. So a lot of our clients keep let's just say this, trade secrets and know-how, they want to keep separate. If they can keep that out of a patent application and not advise the competitors how to make and use the invention entirely, then they want to keep it out of the patent. So a lot of nuance to this, Duane, and maybe I just opened the Pandora's box there.
No, this is good. So I think for me, right, and then we'll move on to what happens next, is in my world, it was always helping startups connect reimbursement, regulatory, and clinical strategy, right? And then as I started talking to more of them, you know, then all of a sudden I'm on the phone with their attorneys as well, talking about, you know, patent IP strategy. And then I realized how big of a piece that was in those initial discussions. And then there was this fundraising aspect. So all of a sudden more pillars kind of got added in. But I think it was pretty much after the episode we did together that I realized how important IP strategy was, you know, in that early phase. So okay, so let's you have the provisional, the year's up, then what happens?
Well, then you have a couple of options. You can file a non-provisional application, and that's only good in the U.S. I'm basing it just being here in the U.S. Or you can file a PCT, which is a patent cooperation treaty application, which essentially gives you the right to file in other countries months from the date you filed the PCT application. So typically, if you file the provisional application, 12 months after that, you can file a PCT application. And then 18 months after that, or 30 months from when you filed the provisional application, you can then file in whatever jurisdictions you want. And that extra 18 months or year and a half from filing the PCT application gives you that time to figure out which countries do you want to file in. The costs can really add up over time. Because the cost of file the provisional, the cost to file the PCT application, the cost to file in all these other countries, you know, 18 months after filing the PCT application. If you're filing in countries in which English isn't the language, you have to get translations. So there's cost involved there. I mean, if you're an unsophisticated, that's not the best word. If you're a person who's new, yes, that's better. For someone that's new to the patent world, this can really make your head spin. Just the amount of cost and the manner in which they add up over time.
Let me put some flavor to that. If you're going to go into some of our clients, biotech, pharmaceutical, which is typically the most expensive, sometimes artificial intelligence. But if you're going to go into, let's just say, Korea, China, Japan, non-English, as Neil mentioned, if you're going to go into, a lot of our clients, of course, go into Canada, United States, Europe, but then some go into Israel, some go into countries around the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, Singapore. You're looking at $150,000 to $250,000 in translations, government fees, and any attorney work in each of those jurisdictions.
Wow.
So, yeah, a quarter $1 million just to go in. That doesn't include all of the prosecution costs, the negotiations with each of the examiners in each of those countries.
Not to mention actually taking the product to market there.
Exactly.
Holy cow. I did not realize it was that much more expensive. Okay. So Niall, what was your next step? You had the provisional, right? You know, what did you do after that? What kind of strategy were you deploying there in the next phase of your company?
Sure, right. And it's not just one provisional, right? There are multiple series of provisionals because ultimately there are different ways to protect this idea. So you want to start with the broadest possible set of claims, which are define the ultimately the protection that a patent affords. Mm-hmm. But you can tease it out into systems, into methods, into devices, into features on that device. So you want to have a shotgun approach, and the provisional patent application system really it kind of enables that. So you can come up with an idea and file it, then come up with another idea that files it. Maybe it's a subset, or maybe it's tied to it in some other way. So I think the next step is to think of more things, is to start to stack those patent applications up together, to start to have a cohesive strategy that defines, you know, perhaps your system, perhaps your methods of achieving an end result, all the way down to the physical thing that you expect to sell, and maybe even microscopic features on that physical thing that you aim to sell. So putting together that kind of strategy, doing a full attack on, and using the provisional patent application will enable you to go to the next step, which would be coming up with a minimum viable product, or an MVP, or a prototype of some kind that you can start to take that idea and put it into a tangible form that makes communication of that idea, of the benefits, of the impact of that idea a lot easier. So you can show people, you can help them understand why you're pursuing this and why it's good for the benefit of humanity, what kind of impact it can have on the market. And that requires obviously some design skills. So you need to design a device. And then you also need to be able to manufacture it. So 3D printing is one way, but there's also other ways, whether it's a molded part or it's a traditionally machined part. And there are subsets of those manufacturers out there that are willing to do work for you for a price. So you begin to put these prototypes together, begin to show them around, you begin to use them to your advantage to either raise money, to garner interest where someone may want to license this product or acquire this company outright. But now you have something that you can show relatively easily.
Okay. So you're kind of bringing up a point here where you're talking about, where someone might acquire this, right? So have you had those discussions with strategics? Maybe not with this company, right? But in the past, you've maybe had those conversations?
Yes. They okay. go on kind of nonstop once you either you're receiving, pitches from people like this is yeah. a good idea, or you're pitching your idea to someone else. So okay. that's one rather quick way to get your idea into the market is to have someone with an established distribution network, an established supply chain that can take these ideas and turn them into products and then can take those products and get them to the field.
Okay.
As opposed to, building that from scratch, which is the job of a company, not the job of a person.
Yep. So when strategics reach out to startups, and this is a question for all three of you, so one at a time, because I know you're all going to be super anxious to answer it. So when a strategic engages a startup about possibly purchasing them, right? In my world, some of the big things that you have to check off are reimbursement. Right. I mean, if people aren't going to pay for this, then I'm sure they're not interested. Quality system, because a lot of strategics have been burnt by poor quality systems coming in from startups. But now you're talking about patents, and I always knew this, right? But I'm not involved in those conversations. What are those like? I mean, are they drilling you on how you've protected your product? I mean, how concerned are the strategics with that aspect before purchasing you?
You want us to go? Okay, so there is one gap in there though, Dwayne, and okay. I think FDA regulatory pathway is really critical. So reimbursement, mm-hmm. of course.
Yep.
Certainly QMS, all of the different regulatory, but really FDA path, 510K de novo or PMA. You hope to avoid PMA if you can. Mm-hmm. The more expensive route, or there's one additional route, which is avoiding the FDA altogether.
Right.
Niall can't do that, but or maybe you can, Niall, if you found a clever way to exactly.
Nope. Not a chance.
But a lot of clients in the medical device space can avoid if it's not classified as a medical device, then you can avoid the FDA sometimes. So mm-hmm. that's a kind of a critical juncture. But in any case, what you're talking about is due diligence mm-hmm. and the and so potential acquirers, potential investors, sometimes even potential licensees. It depends on what the device is. They will do due diligence and they will look at how. So especially if you're doing safety and efficacy or bioequivalence or some kind of equivalence studies, they're going to be looking at how that data is incorporated into the IP strategy and how the IP strategy is going to protect what is actually going on the market. So it's great to file a patent application, but if your claims in the patent application don't protect what's going on to the market, who cares? So you've got to really coordinate everything you said, Dwayne, but add in the FDA regulatory with all of those safety, efficacy, and equivalent studies so that you're protecting what you predict is going to go onto the market. So that's really nuanced, and that requires, here's the cross-functional team. You have to have the people that can translate between law, business, and science. You just have to, or else the IP strategy is going to falter. Your FDA regulatory strategy could be off target, or you have just a bunch of Me Too products entering the market real quick. It's tricky, and everybody, science, business, and law, you just have to talk at this critical juncture where we are right now in the hypothetical.
Okay, this is helpful. I'm going to save this question for later on once we get through this hypothetical situation, because it's something that's come up in the past, and I'm curious on how it works. And we'll just leave it there as a little foreshadowing. Okay, so Niall, your actual product, it's called what is it?
Aprevo.
Aprevo, that's right. Okay, so what is Aprevo? Just a brief intro into what that is, because I think that probably leads into my next series of questions.
Sure, it's a patient specific surgical plan for correction of a spinal pathology, and the physical implant to achieve that plan that is delivered surgically by the surgeon in the operating room with the patient asleep on the table.
Okay, so there's an implant, and then there's what, an algorithm, AI, machine learning, something on the back end?
Yeah, there's a plan, and that plan occurs before the physical implant. So the plan is there's a series of bones that define your backbone or your spine. And those bones, if they become malaligned through aging or degeneration or deformity, become out of alignment. And so the Aprevo product takes a look at its current pathology, its current condition, the arrangement in space of those bones of the body, puts them into a preferred alignment, an optimal alignment. And from there, we design the implant, and then we manufacture the implant that achieves that organization of the spine.
Okay. So is there AI machine learning involved in this process? Okay.
Yeah.
So
there's a machine learning algorithm that uses the last series of data to inform the next correction maneuver.
Okay.
So it's a feedback loop machine learning. Yep. There's an opportunity for this to improve over time.
Great. Let's open up this can of worms. So machine learning, is this something that is patentable and that could be a Pandora's box? I don't know. And this is from my very elementary understanding, is that generally speaking, machine learning and AI is difficult to patent.
So, it depends how you try to patent it. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to claim a mathematical formula, you'll get kicked out of any patent office in the world in about 3 seconds.
Okay. So
you just can't patent a formula. Can't do it. But if you look at dynamic systems, which include kind of a software implementation of certain hardware or an entire system just comprising of software, but you look at different novel and non-obvious portions of a machine learning pipeline. So your data set or a data set or combination of data sets is the basis on which a machine learning algorithm is trained. Okay. So that in and of itself, the combination of data sets and the way that you're correlating data, the way that the algo is being trained using that data set or combination of data sets, that could all be novel and non-obvious. Okay, the next part is the algo itself, the engine in this pipeline. That engine itself, the way that it processes that data and then provides an output, that in and of itself could be patentable. It has to be novel, non-obvious, but most importantly, patent eligible. So if you're working So if you're trying to claim something that is not dynamic, has low accuracy, how do I say this? Low sensitivity, low specificity, lots of false positives, lots of false negatives, you're just going to get thrown out of the patent office. If you have something, however, which is better than all the rest, it's dynamic, it's personalized, such as the device that Niall's talking about. You're not just a cookie cutter. You're not providing the same solution to every patient. That's the type of dynamic, personalized system which is patentable. So you have to claim it in the right way. You have to define it in the right way. And that's all about, that's kind of the art of drafting a patent application. But yes, to answer your question, it is patentable. You just have to do it the right way.
Okay. Niall, how much can you share with what your strategy was with that, with Carlsmed?
Sure. I think we kind of scratched on it. Kevin kind of scratched on it earlier, where deciding the method of protection. So there have been several instances where we got a great idea kicking around in our collective heads. And okay, oftentimes you get pushed to, all right, let's hurry up and file this before anyone else comes up with this idea. So at times we've kind of had to temper that enthusiasm for filing because it is such a valuable idea. And as Kevin and Neil described, one of the trade-offs in the patent world is you get exclusive protection to keep other people from practicing this invention in exchange for full disclosure of how to make and use this. So that kind of back and forth, that trading, maybe for some things isn't really worthwhile. So on several instances, we've anticipated this being a patent application, but ultimately, we decided to protect it using trade secrets and confidentiality within our business organization in order to really maximize the power of this idea, of this invention, without disclosing it to the outside world. That includes ultimately our competitors.
And there's some nuance there too. So okay, patent it, the patent application publishes, your competitors know what you're doing. Okay. So that's why you wouldn't want to disclose your secret sauce. But here's the corollary. If you keep it trade secret, if you keep it know-how, a competitor can patent it around you. So while you're keeping it trade secret, your competitors can catch up to you and patent it. Even though it's your trade secret, you will be infringing somebody else's patent application if they decide to patent it around you. So you got to be careful both ways. And we really have to be careful as attorneys. We have to be careful to really advise our clients very well on that. There are trade-off both ways.
Yeah,
Okay.
in addition to finding yourself in as the original inventor and then not being able to practice because you
Exactly.
decided to keep it, there's also the opportunity for someone to not just protect that idea, but to use it because they reverse engineered your solution. So you've entered the marketplace. You've just by virtue of entering the marketplace, there's some level of disclosure of this idea because you have to sell it or it has to be somehow ascribed value. And to do that, there's an element of disclosure. Now, all of a sudden, someone can take that, do an end run around on the reverse engineering side, and you don't not only are you out without protection, but now you've just informed the competitor as to how to enter the market and perhaps take advantage of you. So it's a real delicate balance there.
Yeah. And there's a lot of ways to disclose an invention too. One is by talking to the FDA. One is trying to get a CPT code for something. There is disclosure there as well. So it's not just filing a patent application, it gets published. It's you're talking to the government in this space, in the medical device space. If you have to do clinical trials, there is a level of disclosure you have to provide. Clinicaltrials.gov is a great source to learn what your competitors are doing. So there are a lot of ways to screw this up or succeed without providing your secret sauce in a lot of these different disclosures.
Quick side story about clinicaltrials.gov is this is it's not funny because it's someone's company, but it was bursting someone's bubble, just being in the CRO world a while back, right? And seeing a lot of similar products come through. There was a specific PMA product that the inventor had not gone to the FDA yet because they would have canned it as soon as they saw it because there was already a company that was going through that process. But I had to just gently refer him to clinicaltrials.gov where he found out that a competitor
Yeah.
was already in the clinical trial, which means the FDA is not going to see another PMA on that same claim,
Yeah.
right? So it kind of stinks, but yeah, it's a good point. Can someone define trade secrets?
Ah, so this is kind of fun. So I always like to use an analogy of baking bread. And so there's kind of a distinction between trade secret and know-how. So the recipe for bread, something that can be written down, locked away, and kept from public view, the recipe itself could be a trade secret, just like Coca-Cola. So the recipe for Coca-Cola is a trade secret. Maybe three people know what the recipe is. So even though Coca-Cola is being sold left and right, anywhere you can see in the world, the formula itself is a trade secret. It can be written down. The interesting thing about know-how is you can't write it down. When you're baking bread, you got the recipe, you put the flour, the water, and yeast or whatever in a mixture. To show somebody how to knead the bread, I cannot write down, you know, I'm pushing with, you know, 20 Newton meters of force with, you know, this part of my hand, and you just can't write it down. You have to show somebody. So that's the distinction between trade secret and know-how. But to answer your question, trade secret, it's written down, you lock it away, keep it away from public. You should also know that it's a patchwork of laws. So most states have its own unique trade secret law. And even though there is a federal cause of action for trade secret theft, the definition of trade secret could be different in each United state.
Okay, interesting. For general reference, next time you're speaking to someone with the last name Mancini, you could just use pasta sauce as a probably a pretty good good analogy here, because my grandparents, my great aunts and uncles, this is like the constant fight with them, is probably trade secret versus know-how of, will you write how to make your sauce down on a piece of paper, please, and then show me how to do it, because it's incredibly frustrating. So anyways, okay, very cool. So what did I ask to even spark all of this? I think it was referring, Niall, to what you had done with your algorithm. Okay, so what else am I missing in this evolution of story? What's next? I mean, I guess for me, right, like I understand this beginning part now. How does your engagement with IP attorneys evolve? I mean, at some point, does it just go, okay, great, we're done? Or is it a continuous like ebbs and flow of various things?
Yeah, once you start, you really can't stop.
Okay.
So at the risk of, you know, taking a slogan from maybe Pringles or something like that, once you pop, you can't stop. So you need to engage them when you feel as though you got an idea that needs protection, that's worthy of protection. And the way that you find patent attorneys is, you know, typically through your network, patent attorneys or patent agents. And I can tell you that probably the first one that you meet that maybe files your first provisional patent application, it in the evolution of your business might not be the patent attorney or agent who you're using today. Oftentimes resources are constrained, so you find an economical solution at the beginning. But as this idea takes on, you know, a life of its own, and perhaps capital raise events have occurred, you've closed a round, it may be time to get a little more sophisticated. And that's where, you know, groups like the Torrey Pines Law Group, who are far more sophisticated than perhaps a single patent agent who lives around the corner from you, you know, as a solo practitioner, maybe part-time, Torrey Pines Law Group will give you far more sophisticated solutions, and they'll partner with you on the strategy, not just the mere execution of a list of things that you think should be done. So you'll be looking for some legitimate strategy and some insight as the developer of a product that is becoming more mature. You're going to want to get some more sophisticated patent counsel.
Okay. Kevin, Neil, I have additional questions I want to ask the three of you as well, but to close this out, maybe we'll start with Neil and then go to Kevin. Is there anything else that you want to add to this?
Well, that I would first like to say thank you, Niall, for providing an excellent commercial.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Niall.
Really appreciate it. But yeah, so one of the things to consider is when you're working with a patent agent or patent attorney on your invention is that even once you get a patent issued, that might not be the end of it. Perhaps you get the patent issued and you think, maybe I could have broadened this out a little mm-hmm. bit more. And then you might want to file a continuation application. Of course, you want to make sure you file that continuation application before the first application issues as a patent. So this very well could be something that's ongoing. You just keep filing these additional applications to provide more protection for your invention. And also in the event that you come up with the improvements too, you can always file continuation in part applications.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The real basic term for that is product lifecycle management. And that's from a patent attorney perspective, that's kind of a subfield of patent work. Everybody like Niall, so you file a provisional non-pros filed a year later. If you get a patent based on that non-pro filing, the patent term will end 20 years after filing the non-pro. Mm-hmm. Okay. What if you have an improvement? Okay. Sometimes you file a brand new patent application de novo on the improvement. What if you have version 2.0, of the, whatever the iterative process is to develop the better product? You want to protect that, of course, too. You want to get that approved to the or cleared through the FDA. You want to get a CPT code for that improved version 2.0 product. Patent it. So that's called product lifecycle management, just generically. And that's why you kind of keep your you want to keep your kind of specialist patent attorneys around. And some of our clients we've represented for 9 years since the inception of the law firm. So it's quite a long time. But here's the dirty secret, Duane. Sometimes it's not up to Niall. So if Niall chooses his best patent attorney, let's say that he gets an investment from Kosla Ventures. Guess who determines who the patent attorney is? Kosla Ventures. It's not going to be Niall anymore.
Yep.
So that's why. Law firms are switched midstream sometimes. We're lucky we get investors recommending us, but sometimes cases get taken away.
Sure. Okay. So real quick, I'm starting to, just from being in the regulatory space, starting to realize maybe how closely IP patents and regulatory go hand in hand.
Oh yeah, right?
Because you're starting to say things that I would recommend on the regulatory side of, hey, next indication for use, or yep, next second generation. So okay, this helps. This makes a lot of sense in my brain now. I want to get into that investor piece real quick again. But real quick, I got to get this question out. This is one I was asking before. So. It was like episode 3 or 4 of our MedTech Money series is with a investment bank group called Mavi, and they pretty much help raise money for you. If you have a product, you can license it to China for non-dilutive equity. How does this work in a patent IP licensing? Because you're giving up your license. Your licensing capabilities in China. So if you're ever to get acquired by a strategic, they can't sell that product in China because someone already owns the rights to that. So how does this work from a patent side? Are patents involved in it anywhere in this space, or how does this work?
Sure. So I'll take the first stab at it. Patents, before you have something to sell, before you have something that people are going to describe, ascribe value to, the non-tangible assets that you have are the IP. So if you have, fantastic claims on a series of patents and you want to license them, that you need to understand the business of licensing that. And there are downstream impacts to that, intended or unintended, that may become encumbrances for a potential, big exit or a big payday on the tail end of it. So, Duane, just as you described, giving away a license to, you know, practice an invention in China, you could imagine a Johnson & Johnson or a Medtronic would walk away from a deal. That market in China, you've kind of given away, and they don't have an opportunity to extract value from that in the way of paying customers of, you know, 1.5 billion people. So you need to really think hard. Is this, you know, what do you have here? Are you looking for a short play, or are you looking for a long play? And to derive the maximum value may take a bumpier, a longer road, but it may be worth it.
Okay. All right. Kevin, Neil, you have something to add here?
Yeah. This is so tricky. I mean, so the first thing is, to license it in China, you got to have a pending patent application or patent in China. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's why this gets expensive. So when you're going, you know, provisional PCT at the 12-month mark, at the 30-month mark, you're going into China, Korea, Japan, getting all the different translations, paying the government fees. That's why it's expensive. You got to protect it in China to be able to, you know, adequately license it in China. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's step one. Now, because we're talking about a highly regulated environment, if you're going to be licensing in China, do you have to go to NMPA, which is the equivalent of the FDA in China, to get this cleared in China? That's expensive. So it's not only licensing the patent, it's getting the exclusivities and the clearances in China to make any money there. Okay. Then we're talking about, in addition to that, supply and distribution. Who's on first? What's on second? I mean, maybe I'm dating myself, guy, but you gotta know who is distributing the product in China. Do they also have exclusivities in Korea, Japan, Singapore? You know, so you gotta carve out in a term sheet and then in a final, you know, a final agreement, you know, who's got control, market authorization holder, who is doing the studies in China to get it cleared or approved there, depending on the technology. Then here's the kicker. So we've been involved in a lot of these international deals, and phenotype, what population you're studying to go into different markets really makes a difference. So if you're in the United States and you're looking at we're a pretty big melting pot here, but we are not studying, for example, one of our clients is focused on mammograms. Women's breasts are different in each culture. And so their product in the United States is going to be different than it would be in Japan if the artificial intelligence algo was being trained on Japanese patients, for example. Japanese patients are different than Chinese patients, which are different than Israeli patients, which are different than Hungarian patients. That becomes critical too. So this is so complex, Duane, that it's not just patents that are involved. You gotta look at the entire pipeline, the entire commercialization process worldwide really quickly, or else you're going to screw up and you're not going to be able to license this to China.
Yeah. Okay. That's a great addition there. I had come up a while back, and, you know, I just had I'd given it so much thought, and I'm sure there's positives, right? But I think you kind of put it in a good spot there, where there's some short-term benefits, maybe long-term, you know, downside, just depending on where you want to exit. Kevin, you brought up the famous skit, who's on first, what's on second, you know. any person who started at NAMSA, the old company I was with, if they started while John Gorski was the CEO, then they've seen that video, because he shows it at every training, no matter where you are in the world. So everyone has seen that. It's such a classic skit, though. Before I digress too much here, is there anything else? I'm just aware now that we're 52 minutes in. I was not aware we've been talking that long. This has been, and this happens for me when I'm learning about things I don't know about, right? So, and I don't know about this space. So I certainly appreciated all the insight. In closing, is there anything I missed? that you want to leave the listeners with? Again, Niall, is there anything there?
Yeah, if you got a good idea and you really believe in it and the world needs it, go pursue it with everything you got. Don't go in halfway. You'll never reach the end.
Awesome. Neil, Kevin?
Well, now provided a wonderful commercial for Torrey Pines Log Group, I was hoping you would do the same as well, Glenn.
Look, there'll be a plenty. So summarize here. I kind of did. I'll include the LinkedIn profiles to all three of yours in the show notes. All the companies, there'll be a link to the website here as well. So depending on what platform you're listening on, up or down an inch, and you'll be able to connect with them. I'm guessing everyone's active on LinkedIn for the most part. So if people need to reach out, they can. So for the listeners, they're all shaking their head. Yeah, guys, this has been great. And hang on for 1 minute. We'll chat offline. But thanks again for your time.
Thanks for the
Thank you, Dwayne.
Absolutely. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you need anything from the podcast, you can always contact us at info@projectmedtech.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.